Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Crosby Kemper, the director of the Kansas City Public Library, and we're very glad to have all of you here and honored to present Sue Ellen Fried and Blanche Soslin. You know, this is an important subject, and Sue Ellen Fried and now her co-author Blanche Soslin have become the nation's greatest experts on the subject of bullying behavior, and also have had, I think, a major impact. Over 40 states have passed legislation on bullying. Sue Ellen has appeared on the Today Show, MSNBC, Bill Curtis special reports on A&E on bullying. She founded in 2002 Bully Safe, a program that she's delivered to over 85,000 students in 36 states. Sue Ellen has written two books before this book on bullying, Bullies and Victims, and then co-authoring with her daughter, Dr. Paula Fried, Bullies, Targets, and Witnesses in 2003. And now with Blanche, Blanche Soslin, who has been for many years a professor of reading and education at Park University, she's co-authored Banishing Bullying Behavior. And I think all those of us who've had school children or been school children, I think that's all of us, know what a problem this is and how the internet has changed things and left us with really no space to feel safe in and no way to know for sure if our children are targets, are victims, or perpetrators for that matter. And it's a disturbing trend in the world, and it's good to know that two of Kansas City's smartest, most active, and most accomplished women are on top of the situation. So would you please welcome, as I introduce, Sue Ellen Fried and Blanche Soslin.
Crosby, thank you so much for that very generous introduction, and also for everything that you did to prepare us for this evening. I'd also like to, or Sue Ellen and I would both like to thank as well, Henry Fortunato, Claudia Baker, Katie Taylor, Todd Boyer, and Michael Gardner, as well as the entire staff of the library who have been so supportive and so generous in their getting prepared for this evening. I'd like to thank all of you for coming and sharing your concern with us and allowing us to share our concern with you about, as Crosby said, this very, very important topic. Actually, the full title of our book, as published, is Banishing Bullying Behavior, Transforming the Culture of Pain, Rage, and Revenge. However, Sue Ellen and I had submitted the title, Banishing Bullying Behavior, Transforming the Culture of Pain, Rage, and Revenge, with Kindness, Calm, and Empathy. However, our publisher told us in no uncertain terms that that was just too long to put on a book cover. We would like you to keep that in mind, because that really underscores what our book is all about. I'd like just to take a moment to give you an idea of how our collaboration came about. After Sue Ellen and Paula published their first book, I read it and was really taken by the entire book and felt that every college professor and every classroom teacher should read that book. But there were two things that really hit me between the eyes. Number one, the statistic that very few children are comfortable going to their teachers when they are in trouble with bullies. And as someone who was preparing teachers, I felt that it was important for me to prepare my students to make their students comfortable when they are being bullied. The second factor was that 160,000 students miss school every single day because of bullies. And that's just not acceptable. Unfortunately, I think that statistic still stands. And unfortunately, recent research, as recent as just 2 months ago, indicates that students still are not comfortable going to their teachers. And it's a real problem for the schools, because students need to be comfortable in order for the schools to intervene and to help banishing bullying behavior. So I adapted Sue Ellen and Paula's text to use as a text in several of my classrooms, classroom management, a course that I taught on diagnosing and reading problems, because kids who have problems in school are often bullied. And Sue Ellen and I started to collaborate on how to deal with this very, very serious issue. And both of us felt it was important to write a book that other college professors could use in their courses. And we submitted a proposal, and our editor suggested that although this was an important audience, he felt it should be have a much broader audience, and we have seen that he was right on that. So I'm going to turn this over to Sue Ellen, who will give you a little background on how the first book was conceived, and we'll go on from there.
Thank you, Blanche. Way back in the 1970s, our daughter Paula went away to college, but when she would come back in the summertime, she worked at KU Medical Center on the pediatric oncology unit. And one of those summers, she connected with a little girl by the name of Kimberly Weisel, who had been diagnosed with cancer when she was 7 years old. And Kimberly proceeded to have chemotherapy and went into remission. But when she was 10, the cancer came back fiercely. And the doctors felt that the only way to save Kim's life was to have her spend her entire summer getting massive doses of chemo. So Paula and Kim saw each other Monday through Friday all during the summer and became very close friends. And then as August rolled around, Paula and Kim both knew that Kim was not going to survive. And Paula was going to go away to college, and Kim was going to go away, was going to go to school in the fifth grade. And they didn't know if they would ever see each other again, so Paula suggested that we invite Kim and her mom to come to our house for lunch so they could have a kind of a special farewell. So we were sitting there chatting and eating and laughing and having the most delightful afternoon, and I heard Paula lean over to Kim and she said, "Kim, are you looking forward to going back to school?" And Kim said, "I am counting the days. I have not seen a single friend for 3 months. I can't wait until school starts." And then I heard Paula ask her if she had any concerns about going back to school. And Kim thought for a moment, and she said, "Recess." And I said, "Recess? Kim, with everything that you're facing, how can recess be something that is of such concern to you?" And she said, "Well, you see, at recess, there are some kids who think it's fun to pull my wig off of my head. And then when I'm standing there in the middle of the playground, a group of kids form a little circle. And they point, and they laugh, and they make fun of me because I'm bald." And Paula and I never recovered from that conversation. And it led many years later to our first book, which was published in 1996. And we had a terrible time getting it published. It took us over a year and a half to get a publisher. Because in 1996, nobody believed that bullying was worth writing or reading about. And then Columbine happened in 1999, and suddenly the world discovered bullying. So as the years have gone by, then suddenly there was a tremendous amount of research and data that was available. And so Paul and I wrote a second book to kind of capture the plethora of information that surfaced after the Columbine tragedy. And then Blanche and I decided to do a third book that would be really focused on transforming the culture of the schools. And I think language is really important when we're talking about this, because our first book, we used the term victims, bullies and victims. And we learned from students and teachers that we should never have used that word, that victims implies helplessness. So by the second book, we changed it to targets, because if you're a target of bullying, there's a possibility that you can deflect it or that it might not even touch you. And then I love that by the time Blanche and I started working on this, we aren't even labeling children anymore. We're not calling kids bullies or targets. We are talking about banishing the behavior. And one of the things that I began to observe over the years was that there is a cycle that happens. And I explained to the kids that if you inflict pain on someone, the pain does not evaporate. It doesn't disappear. And pain collects. So if you can imagine a clock, and if noon is pain, and then if we go down here to 4 o'clock, the pain collects and becomes rage. And then the rage collects, and if we come back over here to about 8 o'clock, it becomes revenge. And then revenge causes pain, and the cycle completes itself. And so for many years, I was explaining this to children and trying to help them understand that this pain, rage, and revenge cycle that begins in preschool, elementary school, and works its way on up, escalates into all of the global conflicts that we're having today. Because if you look at everything that is happening between tribes and cultures and regions and religions, it started with some group's feeling of violation and feeling terribly pained by what has happened to them, and then the rage, revenge. And I know everybody in this audience can think of all this cycle that has gone on. But one day when I was explaining this, a boy came up to me and he said, "You need to draw another cycle." He said, "Because I experience the pain, but I don't turn to rage. I turn it inward and I get depressed. And then when I get so depressed, I get to the point where I want to commit suicide. And the only reason I don't is because I think of the pain that it would cause my parents." So we realize that children are using this pain to take them either in outward aggression or inward depression, but we have to really help children understand how important it is to stop the pain. So the thing that I love to do the most is to go into the classroom and start asking the children questions, because their wisdom is what has filled all of our books. They have so much information, and I want to share with you the things that I've learned from them. I do have to tell you that the very first question I ask the children is, "How many of you have heard of child abuse?" And of course, all the hands go up, and then I ask for a definition, and kids give me very logical, thoughtful answers about what child abuse is. And then I explain to them that when I was their age, we didn't even have the term child abuse in the English language. And so I explained to them that if you are suffering, if you're in pain, if you're hurting, it doesn't make any difference if the person that's causing you the pain is an adult or your peer. And all of our child abuse laws only describe child abuse when the perpetrator is an adult. And I want the children to see how serious this is. That is not a benign, boys will be boys, everybody has to go through it. So then after that, I ask them if they would please tell me about the five kinds of bullying. What is physical bullying? And they tell me that it's tripping, punching, choking, stabbing somebody with a pencil, using your hands, your fingers, your elbows, knees, any part of your body to cause pain for somebody. And then I say to them, all right, well now, what is verbal bullying? But before you give me examples, would everybody please finish this sentence? So, class, please finish this sentence. Sticks and stones can break your bones, but words will never hurt me. This sentence has been passed down for at least five generations to every child in America, and it isn't true. So what I'm trying to teach the children is a new sentence, which is sticks and stones can break your bones, but words can break your heart. And then when I ask kids, how many have had a broken bone, and the hands go up, and we find out that a broken bone can take anywhere from 3 weeks to a year to heal. And I say to them, how long do you think it takes to heal a broken heart? And without exception, the class will say either forever or never. So then they tell me that verbal bullying is name-calling, put-downs, gossiping, cursing, swearing, talking about somebody's mama, talking about somebody behind their back, laughing at them. And then we go on to emotional bullying and explain to the kids that emotional bullying is when there is no physical contact and there are no words. And I ask them, what can you do to cause pain? And they say that you can give somebody the evil eye, that you can turn your back on them, that you can walk away from them, that you can use sign language, that you can use, I don't have to do it for you, but I have learned a lot of signs that I didn't need to know. So we talk about the cruelty of the isolation, the birthday parties, where everybody in the class gets invited but a few children, and then everybody comes back from the birthday party and talks about what a great time they had. And then we go on to sexual bullying, and this is kind of squirmy for the kids. But I say it's really important, we have to talk about this. And so they will say that sexual bullying is when you touch somebody in a place where they shouldn't be touched, or you discriminate and say you can't do this because you're a girl or you're a boy. And they will say it's when you try to pressure somebody to do something that they don't feel comfortable about. And then every once in a while, a very brave child will say, it's when you call somebody gay or queer or fag or homo or lesbo. And I am so grateful when the children bring it up. But if they don't, I do. Because there have been over 40 shootings in this country in schools, and every single one of those boys that brought a gun to school and murdered and killed their classmates and some teachers who are in prison have been interviewed. And what the interviewers learned was that those children that brought their guns to school and committed murder were not bullies. Those were the targets. Those were the children who experienced the pain, and it turned to rage, and it became revenge. And then when they asked them further, what was so horrendous that it provoked them to kill their classmates? A majority of them said it was because they were relentlessly called gays, queers, fags, homos. And so I explained to the children that this language is extremely lethal and that we have to talk to our children about not using those words. And then we go into cyberbullying. And oh my gosh, as Crosby alluded, the hurtfulness that can come. It's one thing when you know who your bully is, and even if you can't make it stop, you can keep trying, you can have strategies, you have some idea of who that person is. When somebody anonymously goes on the computer and makes up stories about you and sends it out to tens of hundreds and thousands of people are reading things about you that are absolutely not true, you have no defense. You have no defense. There is a new word that is going to end up in the dictionary, and it's called bully side. And it is, there is even a book that was written, 8 mothers told the stories of their children who committed suicide because of bullying. And cyberbullying was a major factor. So then I asked the kids, why does somebody become a bully? And the kids will say, because they've got problems at home, because they've been bullied by older brothers and sisters or siblings, because they need attention desperately, because they're jealous, because they don't feel good about themselves and they try to put everybody else down. They want everybody else to suffer. And then every once in a while, a child will touch me so deeply and they'll say, I think some kids become bullies because there's sorrow in the family. Maybe their parents are getting a divorce. Maybe somebody's died. And they just don't know how to handle the pain, and so they come to school and they dump it on us. And then we talk about why do some kids become targets? And they always start out by saying, because they're different. And so then I say to them, well, you realize that you can get picked on if you're too tall or too short, too heavy or too thin, too smart or too slow, too rich or too poor, if you have different color hair, different color skin, if you come from a different culture, if you speak a different language, if you've been put up a grade, if you've been put down a grade, if you have freckles, if you wear glasses, if you have braces, if you buy your shoes at Walmart instead of the Nike store, if you like poetry instead of football, well, the list just goes on and on. And so I said to them, every single one of you in this room is different. It cannot be that being different is what causes bullying. What causes bullying is that some kids who are terribly needy are getting pleasure out of causing pain. And if you want to cause pain for somebody, you will always be able to find something to make fun of them about. So little by little, I am trying to help children understand that bullies are problemed and that they're not as omnipotent as they seem. And I want targets to feel that they have more power. And so then we start talking about strategies and what you can do to get bullies to leave you alone. And we go through a lot of things and they come up with absolutely amazing answers. And then we start talking about the difference between the way girls and boys bully. And what I have learned is that boys are more physical and sexual, and girls are more verbal, emotional, and cyberbullying. And the second thing is that boys are in your face and girls are behind your back. And the third thing they've taught me is that when boys get into some kind of a conflict with each other, they get into a big issue about it, and 5 minutes later they go skateboarding together. But when girls get into these issues with each other, it goes on and on and on for years. And then they've taught me that when boys bully, they tend to bully one-on-one, but when girls bully, they get a clique or a group to go after someone. And the final thing I've learned is that when boys bully, they tend to pick on somebody outside of their circle of friends. But when girls bully, they turn on their closest friends overnight without any recourse to the girls that are on the receiving end. So then we start talking about empathy, because this is where we really need to go with our children. And I'm amazed when I ask, who can give me a definition of empathy? How few children in our country can give a definition of that word. They all know a definition of sympathy, and it has one more letter in it than empathy, so it can't be because it's too big of a word. It's just not in our repertoire to talk to children about empathy. And so I always tell this story, and it was in a book by Dr. Carl Menninger, The Human Mind, and it was about a group of fish that were swimming in a pond. And there was one fish that was upside down and its tail was flapping. And when the fish saw the flapping, weird, upside down fish, they swam away as fast as they could. And Dr. Carr went on to say what they didn't realize was that this fish had a hook in its mouth, and that's why it was doing that behavior. And then he went on to say that during the course of our daily life, we come in contact with so many people who have invisible hooks that we can't see. And if we could see those hooks, we might appreciate that so many people are doing the best thing they can, considering the circumstances that they're in. And I guess the most amazing thing happened when I was working with a group of middle school students, and one boy had raised his hand after I did my list of, you know, all the reasons you can get picked on, and he said to me, you missed one. And I said, what did I miss? He said, hygiene. He said, there was a girl in our school that had a terrible body odor. And the kids started, first they didn't pay any attention to her, then they called her names, and then they were tripping her. So the teacher called me up and said, I want you to walk with this girl from class to class and protect her. And he said, the last thing in the world I wanted to do was to spend my day walking with this stinky girl, but the teacher assigned me. He said, well, the thing was, I got to spend so much time with her, I got to know her, and I found out that she was the neatest kid. She was fun, she was smart, she was sharp. So one day I said to her, why don't you take a bath? If you would just take a bath, your whole life would change. And he said, she turned to me and she said, I will never take a bath. And I said, why? And she said, because this is the only way I can keep my father from coming on to me. So share your stories with your children. Teach them about empathy. Help when you're in a carpool, make your carpool a no put-down zone. When there's a pajama party, if you have a Girl Scout troop, if you're involved in coaching kids, do everything you possibly can to help children understand the consequences of cruelty and to become a role model of kindness. Because if the kids that were the most popular were the ones that stood up for each other and took care of each other and did some healing, and if we can just reach this kind of a tipping point, we can make such a difference in so many children's lives. Now, Blanche is going to tell you where the adults come into this picture.
Before I do that, I hope that you were able to visualize a class of children sitting on the floor. There were 60 children sitting on the floor while Sue Ellen conducted this session. About 30 of my students sat in the back of the room and observed Sue Ellen. That was our first collaboration. Number one, her students had absolutely no idea that my students were even there. And at the end of her session, there is a section where the students apologized. Now, these were sixth graders. They were apologizing to each other for things that they had done in kindergarten. It was just unbelievable. So I said to Sue Ellen, you know, you've been doing this for so long. How can my students and I start by having the same effect? And Sue Ellen said to me, you know, the pain is so close to the surface, it will happen. And she was right. The first session that I had with students, it was absolutely as if I had done it forever. And in our present book, chapter 9 is an outline for these sessions. And it is my wish that every teacher in every classroom reads that chapter and does that with her students. The other point I wanted to make was the night before Columbine, I reminded my graduate students that next week we would be discussing Sue Ellen and Paula's book. And I said, as you read it, do try to recall that every article that has been published about some school shooting mentions bullies, one way or another. And again, this was the night before Columbine. And one of my students was so overwhelmed that she wrote a 12-page journal entry based on Sue Ellen and Paula's book. But both of us feel very strongly that the only way that we will be able to banish bullying behavior is if that every person takes part in the process. And in the book, we discuss a number of community people, from starting with school administrators, and we call them change agents. The school administrator sets the tone for what happens in that school. Classroom teachers can do so much, not only by teaching, but by modeling. When we started to work on the book, I approached a director of a preschool and asked her whether I could interview her, told her a little about what we were going to do, about how she handled and handles bullying in her preschool. And she looked at me and she said, "I don't have a problem with bullying. We teach kindness." It sounds so simple, but it works. Physical ed instructors certainly need to help become change agents. So much pain is inflicted in locker rooms and on playgrounds where physical education can sometimes take place. School counselors, obviously, and many of the sessions that I've conducted have been with school counselors who have amazing stories to tell. School psychologists, social workers, the school nurses. I'm sure most of you read the tragic story about Priscilla Prince, who committed suicide in Massachusetts not too long ago. And she had sought refuge with a school nurse. School nurse was the last person that saw her alive. Bus drivers have to be change agents. Cafeteria workers, so much pain is inflicted in cafeterias at lunchtime when children just get up and move away if somebody sits down that they don't want to sit with, or just says to a student, "You can't sit with us." Custodians. We've heard stories about custodians who have realized who the bullies are, who the targets are, and are on the watch out for them, and will go in and pretend to clean up the boys' room if they see a bully going in to the boys' room when a target enters. Obviously, librarians and directors of multimedia centers are tremendous change agents. Music and art teachers can do wonderful things. Playground supervisors are key. So much goes on the playground that has to stop. School secretaries are tremendous change agents, as are crossing guards. So the list goes on, but that just gives you an example of how very many people are involved, need to be involved, and are involved, and hopefully will be able to affect change as is certainly needed. On the other hand, bullying is not something that is new. In Ecclesiastes we read there's nothing new under the sun. So I decided to Google bullying in the Bible. How many entries do you think I found? Anybody want to take a guess? Over a million. So you see, there is nothing new under the sun, But hopefully, we will be able to banish bullying behavior. And Sue Ellen is going to close this part of our program with a story.
I hope I'm not... Michael, you'll let me know if I'm doing something with my arms again. I have so much faith in the children. Even the ones that are causing the pain, I feel that we have to start working earlier with them. We know from research that children who are bullies in the third grade and are still bullying by the time they're seniors, 10 years later, those are the kids that one out of four will have a criminal record. So we have to start working with the kids when they're very young. And when they are young, they have a conscience. And they have a sense of right and wrong. And that's why they apologize. It comes from them. We never ask them to apologize. They get the sense of the hurt that they have caused. So what encourages me is when I think about the changes that I've made in my life because of children. For instance, my husband and I smoked. We started smoking when it was romantic and sexy. And then it came along that it wasn't good for your health, but you know, by then we were kind of hooked on it. Our children went to school and saw the pictures of the pink lungs turning black and came home and pleaded with us to give up smoking. It was our children that persuaded us to give up smoking. Well, then seatbelts came out. And I thought to myself, I raised my children, I put all of them in the front seat, stuck my right arm out. If we came to a stop, who needs a seatbelt? My grandchildren will not get into the car and let me drive without putting my seatbelt on. I believe that if we can instill in our children this concept of caring and kindness and compassion and empathy and model it and steep them in it and immerse them in it so that they feel the difference between living in an environment where they are safe and comforted and nurtured as compared to being attacked and brutalized, that there will be this tipping point in our society. But every single one of us has to believe that we can change the culture and that we can influence our children by how we live and how we share our lives with them. And now we want you to please ask us your most challenging questions so that we can help you with whatever issue you have. And I believe there are microphones, and it would really be helpful if you would ask your question at the microphone. And we need one very brave, courageous person to ask the first question. There he is, Steve Robbins. Thank you.
Could you go into the newest version of this, which is the cyberbullying, a little bit further, and explain some of the ramifications and some of the strategies to help dampen that?
Right. Well, you know that they can use cell phones, they can use the internet, they can use all the technology that they have access to. And they are extremely creative about how they do it. I think a lot of you must have read about how some of the girls were sending pictures of themselves when they were undressed to their boyfriends, and then that relationship would end and the boy would send the picture to the football team, and then that girl and that boy in a state in this country were charged with pornography. So the consequences for kids when they do these things with all of this technology is devastating. Not to mention what I was saying before of the terrible stories that they make up. I trained a teacher in Florida, and her son, a group of kids, decided to put onto the internet that he was gay, and he was not. But it didn't make any difference because so many kids made up stories about what he did and what he said. And she came home from school one day, and he had hung himself. So this cyberbullying is absolutely treacherous.
Now, there's a big controversy with cyberbullying because some schools say that because it's not on school property, they will not touch it. Other schools will deal with it. Now, one person who knew that we were working on this book told me the story, and she lives in a suburb of New York. She has two teenage sons, and one Sunday afternoon, four girls and four boys came over to hang out. The four girls went up to her son's room. A couple of hours later, as the kids were leaving, the police car drove up. The girls had cyberbullied another girl, and evidently they had been cyberbullying her before. The girl told her parents, and the police came. So the gamut of dealing with cyberbullying right now is as broad as it can be, and it is just really, really serious.
And Steve, in answer to your question, what can be done about it? There are schools now, there are states that are putting cyberbullying as a definition, and there are schools that are stepping up and saying, even though it happens at the outside of school boundaries, the effect on the kids is so severe that we as a school, and they're bringing in speakers to talk to the kids, and some legal law enforcement people are coming in and talking about how they're now able to track and use technology and they can trace, and that kids will be charged with an offense because of what they're doing. But parents have to take responsibility. They have to supervise the internet with their kids and the technology.
It has affected some students in terms of their college applications.
We live in a very competitive society. It's getting worse and worse and worse. People always have to prove their superiority. I'm better than this and I'm better than that, and you're not. Okay, in some of the schools, the kids show their superiority by being good students and being a lot smarter than the rest of the kids. However, there are those kids that don't fit into that category, and they have to prove that they're bigger and tougher and stronger. And they take it out on the poor kids that are sensitive, that aren't belligerent, and they become victims. The unfortunate thing which you were coming up with is the role of the parents. They have this macho image for their kids, for their sons, and when the kid comes and he goes home and he's crying, the father says, "What are you, a weakling? Come on, I'm going to teach you how to box and I'm going to teach you," and they become bullies after that. So the role of the parents is also as important as it is in the schools.
I appreciate your comment, and the kids agree with you that what happens in the home. I do want to tell you one little short story, though, about parents. There was a boy that was being terribly bullied, and it was physical, and he was being brutalized, and the father was furious, and he kept going to the school to complain, and nothing was happening, and so he finally marched into the principal's office, and the principal said, "I'm going to tell you something, and I shouldn't be sharing this with you, but I think you need to hear it. This boy's father was killed in an automobile accident a few weeks ago, and he has been acting out terribly, and we are all trying to deal with him, and we don't know what to do." And the father of the target went home and called the bully's mother and said, "I'm taking my son fishing next week. Can I take your son with me?" So we just all have to use our hearts and figure out how to help and heal these kids that are hurting each other and hurting themselves.
Before, can I just add one anecdote? The role of the parents is really key. And one of the dilemmas is that children don't want their parents to interfere because they're afraid it'll just get worse. And one youngster was being bullied mercilessly in fifth grade, and he begged his parents not to interfere. Finally, it got so bad that this youngster would wake up in the middle of the night and be throwing up and then not go to school. So the parents said they had to go to school and talk to the principal, which they did. The parents of the bully had no idea. The parents of the bully was a blended family. The bully was being bullied by the stepbrother, and he in turn was bullying this youngster in school. So again, it's so important for parents to know when to they have to intervene and to be helpful for their children. And this story also had a nice ending. These boys are now seniors in high school and they're best friends.
Tying this in with just another part, when you mention bullying, it also relates to molestation. And the terrible thing for some of these poor kids, they would go home and they'd say, my teacher, my whoever was doing it. Parents would deny it. They would not ever admit that and give their kids the guidance that they need. They just ignored the problem. They just couldn't believe that their kids were being abused.
Thank you.
I want to applaud your perseverance on this issue. It's really fabulous. Thank you. Thank you, both of you, both of you. I have a granddaughter who's a freshman in high school this year, and I've asked her, I've really tried to understand what seems to me like this a ferocious epidemic in our country of bullying. And she tells me that a key part of the issue is the entertainment media that the kids are all engaging in, the video games, the music, the lyrics to the music. Would you comment on that, please?
There is such a mean-spiritedness in our society. I like to share the fact that when our children were growing up, our reality show was Leave It to Beaver. And we would sit in front of the television set with our children. If you were to put kids today in front of Leave It to Beaver, I mean, they would howl. We have gone from Jerry Mathers to Jerry Springer in a generation. And so everything that the kids hear, the coarseness, the vulgarity, even the political ads, there is just meanness, and it's permeating them, and they are repeating what they see, hear, feel, taste, smell. And how we are going to, as a society, I mean, some people don't allow their children to watch television anymore because they think that it's, you know, so hard. And the video games, on the one hand, there are video games that are very instructional. On the other hand, there are video games that I can't believe that we are allowing people to make a profit by selling video games where in order to win the game, you have to kill a policeman, you have to have sex with a prostitute and then kill her so you can get the money back. I mean, people are making a profit out of the entertainment media world. Want to answer?
Just as one grandmother to another, one of the things that I have been most amazed about with our book is the number of grandparents who have bought our book for their grandchildren's school library. So evidently, grandparents are being very involved in their grandchildren's school situations.
Yes, I have an intergenerational anecdote. When I was in school, in elementary school, there was a fellow in the class who was a little bit, pardon the expression, different. He's a little slower, a little less confident. And so he drew it. He got all the attention of the bullies and half the rest of the class. I didn't participate in any bullying, but I didn't do what I as much as I could have to stand up with the kid. 40 years later, my son was in the same school with the son of the same guy. And when I went to a parents-teacher conference and saw my former schoolmate and his son. Went home and told my son, I'd like you to befriend this boy. And I told him why. Because although I hadn't participated in the bullying, that I felt guilty about not having had the courage to stand up and defend him when others did. My son did befriend this boy. They worked together on science projects and whatnot. And teachers just assigned them to work together. And that was in the sixth grade. My son's now 21. And he and the fella are still friends. And the boy, they just developed a marvelous friendship. And the boy is a stronger personality now.
Thank you for sharing that. Thank you. And, you know, I would like to close on the role of the... Oh, another question. Okay.
I'm the PTA president of my kids' school, and I would love to have one of our educational sessions be on bullying, cyberbullying. And I've been looking, and I thought the police department would be a good place to start. I've looked at other websites. Do you have any suggestions of where to look for, you know, someone to come into the school and talk to, like, a PTA meeting, to the parents, possibly the students, too?
There are a lot of us out there doing this work, and I think if you just plug in cyberbullying, you'll find a lot of speakers and programs, and I do that work too. Pete Parent mentioned something that we, Blanche and I were saying before we began. Our biggest problem tonight was not what to share with you, it was what to leave out. But the role of the witness is really crucial. And those of you who feel that maybe your child is not a target or your child is not a bully, but all children are witnesses. And there are so many things that witnesses can do. And if you can talk to your children, I mean, challenging the bully takes all the courage in the world, and not every child can be a hero. But just reaching out to maybe include a child in an activity or telling an adult. But we say if you can't do any of those things, if you could talk to your children as a witness and tell them to go up to a target when nobody else is around and just say to them these words, you don't deserve to be treated this way. I wish I could make it stop. It could mean all the difference in the world to a child to hear that. So go home, talk to your children and your grandchildren, and... thank you so much for coming to hear our passion this evening.